higher GDP growth. But it's what's inside that counts. From APM, it's the Marketplace Midday Update podcast. I'm Jeff Horwich, and it's Thursday, November 29th. Along with new GDP numbers, we've got two scintillating new reports to tell you about. One on the British phone hacking scandal. Another looking into what happened to turn a major bank in Afghanistan into a Ponzi scheme. We'll also feature two notable bald people, one on the outs, the other on the upswing.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The Commerce Department today has revised up its estimate of GDP growth in the previous quarter. The initial calculation 1 month ago had the U.S. economy growing at a rate of 2%. The more refined figure now puts it at 2.7. That's no small change, but it's the details behind that number that really matter, and we'll get into it now with Diane Swonk. She's chief economist at Mesirow Financial with me from Chicago. Hi, Diane.
Hello.
So unpack this GDP number for us a little bit.
Well, the upward revisions were really mostly in inventories and exports. Inventories is not exactly the best reason out there to have stronger growth because many of those inventories were unwanted and they now need to be drained as we move into the end of the year and the beginning of 2013. On the other side of it, we saw as much as GDP growth was revised up, the consumer, which we thought had been a star, was revised down, and investment went to a negative from being a positive. That's really important, particularly to the Fed, because investment is not only important to growth today, but it sets a stage for growth going forward, and without investment, we'll have lower potential growth going forward.
And this morning, we also have jobless claims for last week falling, which is the right direction at least, and sales results from chain stores coming in. Can we read much from those two items?
Actually, what we saw was, although jobless claims fell and chain stores came in, we saw the effects of Sandy, Superstorm Sandy, on those numbers still. The jobless claims are still elevated because of the long-lasting effects of hitting Sandy, hit really an artery, an economic artery of this nation in terms of one of its most populous and highest retail sales area. So even though Thanksgiving sales were good and the Black Friday sales were good, they weren't enough at some stores to make up the losses and the disruptions caused by the storm itself. Now, we will have repair and rebuilding, but that means a lot of appliance, carpeting, wood products, and windows instead of traditional Christmas items in that part of the country as we move into December.
Diane Swonk, chief economist at Mesirow Financial. Thank you, as always.
Thank you.
And let's do the numbers. So are investors reacting to that headline GDP number this morning or the less encouraging details we just heard about? Well, you hear the happy music. At least at this hour, the Dow is flat at 12,981. The S&P 500, though, is up about 0.2%, and the NASDAQ is up about 0.3%. Pending home sales in October also jumped to their highest level in almost 6 years. That's more data we had this morning. And CNN has a new boss. The third-place all-news network named former NBC Universal chief Jeff Zucker as its new top executive to try to get them back into the top slots. In corporate earnings, more less-than-gleaming profits for Tiffany & Company. The jeweler with the blue boxes has been especially hit by lower sales in Asia and missed expectations with its earnings released today. Tiffany shares are down this morning about 7%. A year-long investigation into British newspapers following the News Corp phone hacking scandal has culminated today in a new report, the so-called Leveson Inquiry, which is named for Lord Justice Brian Leveson, who led it. The report calls for a new watchdog for the British press, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
Lord Leveson has called for a complicated new system of press regulation that is both voluntary and backed by law. There would be a new arbitration body to deal swiftly with complaints against the press. Fines of up to $1.5 million might be imposed. Newspapers wouldn't have to join the new system, but if they don't, they could find themselves subject to even more rigorous oversight. Media analyst Matthew Horsman says the new system should not pose any commercial threat to the press. British newspapers are already suffering far more from shrinking circulations and falling ad revenues.
I'm convinced that those are much more of a serious, consistent threat to business models in newspapers than any regulatory accommodation that we're going to get out of the Leveson Inquiry.
Over the past 5 years, press revenues in Britain have fallen by a quarter due to internet competition. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Between the U.S. and the U.K., it seems like we've got a new financial scandal every few days here. But there's news of a blockbuster one this week that's about as far from Wall Street as you can get. Kabul Bank was founded in Afghanistan in 2004 to expand commercial banking in the country after the war. It collapsed in 2010 and was taken over by the government. Now a new report puts fresh details to what went wrong. According to the outside investigation, 92% of the loans on the books were fraudulently given out to just a handful of people. The report author labels the bank a Ponzi scheme. For more details, we've got BBC correspondent Bilal Sarwari with me from Kabul. Welcome to Marketplace.
Thank you.
As simply as you can break this down for us, what in the world happened here?
Well, it was a Ponzi scheme. The Kabul Bank people were helping their relatives. The bank management was trying to get rich. And some members of the political structure in Afghanistan. $861 million in fraudulent loans were distributed among these people. So they had houses in Dubai. They were driving in expensive vehicles. They made some very bad investments. You know, when the Kabul Bank disaster was revealed to the media, it had an impact on the fluctuation of currency. Property prices came down, and it discouraged foreign investment in Afghanistan as well.
Part of the idea behind founding Kabul Bank, as I understand it, was to bring banking to more ordinary Afghanis. So what's the potential danger here for this episode on the confidence of people in Afghanistan?
Afghanistan is still a very embryonic society when it comes to banking. You would discover that people would keep hundreds and thousands of dollars in pillows or in clothes. The whole concept of banking was very new. So when Kabul Bank was established, it was counted as a positive post-Taliban success in Afghanistan. And it also meant that millions of Afghan government employees were putting their savings in the bank. But what people did not know, the people who were running the Kabul Bank were at the very center of this fraud. Very, very powerful people were involved with these schemes. And what Afghans are now discovering is that they can simply not trust the idea of putting their savings in banks because they think, well, the same thing could happen with the bank like it happened with Kabul Bank. It has shattered the confidence of people in the financial system.
Bilal Sarwari is the BBC's correspondent in Kabul. Good to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And a quick little technology item here. The Lake Washington School District near Seattle has been battling a computer virus this fall. In September, for the first time, the district gave laptops running Windows 7 to every student above grade 5. But since that time, according to Como TV, they've been besieged by a nasty computer virus called Goblin. Now, this would be just another item on the tech news ticker if not for one unfortunate detail. The Lake Washington School District includes the city of Redmond, which is home to Microsoft. Awkward.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
This week, if you've been following along on the podcast, we've been bringing you a number of stories on the European auto industry. Car makers in Europe are currently facing their own crisis, not unlike the one we had in the U.S. market. Today, reporter Christopher Wirth takes us to Germany to find out how GM is faring in Europe.
All right, I've just climbed into my rental car. It's made by Opel, a company that's owned by GM, but that's lost billions and billions of dollars over the past 10 years. I'm on my way to a factory here in Germany that GM eventually hopes to close. Make this turn here. I ended up in Bochum, an industrial city where GM's Opel plant is the single largest employer. Opel turned down my request for a factory visit, but union members were more than happy to show me the production line.
This is a part of the line before the finish line. We have
Marcus Bauer and other workers oppose GM's plans to close this factory. Bauer stands at an assembly point in a sweatshirt that reads, well, I'll let him translate.
This claim means we stay Bochum. Opel has to stay here in Bochum. Full stop.
Unions are strong in Germany. At Opel and other car makers here, union representatives hold half the seats on company boards. That allows workers to weigh in on big decisions. David Bailey is an auto industry expert at Coventry University. He says that union power is one reason why, since the Second World War, not a single auto plant has closed in Germany.
Companies haven't actually looked to cut plants in Germany so far. That's about to change.
Opel has closed a plant in Belgium, and last month Ford announced plans to close three factories in Belgium and the UK. But for Opel, shuttering the plant here in Bochum could come with a big price tag.
This is in Germany, this is very expensive to lay off people. You can't just switch off the light and go home.
Hans-Peter Merz is with the Chamber of Commerce in Bochum. He says first, GM has to negotiate a large payoff for Opel workers. Then the company is required to retrain those workers and clean up the factory site. All added up, Merz says, this could be the most expensive factory GM has ever closed. In Bochum, Germany, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
And now to those bald guys I promised. The fast food restaurant chain Popeyes is ditching poor old Popeye, the cartoon character. He's been an occasional pitchman for the chain over the past 35 years, but Popeyes has decided to end its $1 million-a-year contract with the comic character's owner, King Features Syndicate. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, explains why.
When you think Cajun chicken, chances are this guy doesn't cross your mind.
I am what I am, and as for what I am, I'm Popeye the Sailor Bird.
First of all, who even remembers Popeye these days? And those who do know he eats spinach, not chicken. Alicia Thompson speaks for Popeyes.
As the brand shifted its focus to more of its Louisiana heritage, there just wasn't any alignment.
Beat it, Buster!
The move makes sense, as restaurant branding consultant Aaron Allen sees it.
They'd be better off to educate the consumer on what is Cajun chicken versus what is Popeye the cartoon.
It seems the name really had nothing to do with that Popeye anyway. The company's spokeswoman says it came from the feisty cop in The French Connection.
Al Copeland, the founder, was a fan of that character and thus named the brand after Popeye Doyle.
Oh, you've never heard of that Popeye either. Yeah, pop culture marches on.
So long, I'll be seeing you. Toodity-doodity-do. I'm Popeye the Sailor Man.
I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
And finally, here's a slick, shiny idea from an entrepreneur in Austin, Texas. Brandon Chikotsky lost his hair in his 20s, but he has embraced that as a money-making opportunity. And last month, Brandon launched a kind of walking billboard business called Bald Logo.
Well, for chump change, you can post an ad or logo on a bald head. We'll pound the pavement and we'll promote your brand.
Brandon has hired a number of other bald people for the team, or at least people who are willing to shave their heads, I guess. To make sure they get noticed while they're walking around, they also dress in full spandex bodysuits. Bald Logo is hoping to expand out of Austin. The company also donates, interestingly, a chunk of its profits to a foundation for alopecia, a disease that causes premature hair loss. Smooth. That's all for the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.